Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is November 16th, 2005. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me today are Bob Novella.
Hello, everyone.
And Perry DeAngelis.
Good evening.
Evan Bernstein, who normally joins us, is not able to make it tonight. So let's start by going over some skeptical news items. There's a few items caught my attention this week. The first is about James Doohan, who many of you may know as Star Trek's Scotty. He died recently, and you may have heard that, according to his wishes, his ashes were to be blasted into outer space.
A
final tribute to Scotty. Scotty, you know, his character was he was the engineer of the Enterprise, and sort of a running bit in the show was conflict between Captain Kirk and Scotty. You know, Kirk was always demanding that he fix the ship and the engines in half the time than was feasible, and Scotty would always do it. Well,
because he said that he would double his time.
He doubled his estimate so that he could have it. So he was to be launched recently in a Falcon 1 rocket. However, ironically, the launch was delayed due to engine trouble.
So now he was on the job. That wouldn't have happened.
That's right. So the rocket launch is now delayed. They say it's not going to fly.
Was there a problem with the dilithium chamber?
I think the dilithium crystals were cracked, and the phase reversal was all out of whack.
Damn harmonics.
So it's not going to fly any sooner than February of 2006. So we will keep you updated about Scotty's final trip into space. Another item that was sent to me by a colleague this week is about...
You have colleagues?
I do. Okay, yeah, they're out there somewhere. The state of Florida has recently launched a study into the benefits of magical or supernatural water as a cure for citrus canker. Now, the canker is basically...
I assume that's a disease on a fruit.
Yes, it's a disease of citrus fruit trees. It is a bacteria.
It's pretty nasty. Apparently, the only thing you could do is destroy the tree and dispose of it properly.
That's right. There's no cure for the bacteria.
There's no salve for the canker or anything like that, I guess.
But because, like anything incurable, that it attracts the quacks and the charlatans, and people are always, you know, offering up their miracle cures. But, of course, you know, the scientists who are in charge of such thing don't pay any attention. But now they decided to do a study of what is called celestial drops, which is this supernatural water. This is classic pseudoscience technobabble. Celestial drops are promoted as a canker inhibitor because of its, this is in quotes, improved fractal design, infinite levels of order, and high energy and low entropy.
Improved fractal design.
That's a new one, I must admit, using a little from chaos theory to bolster your wacky claims.
Right, I mean, it's basically just a nonsensical, incoherent mishmash of scientific-sounding terminology, which is, you know, typical of pseudoscience. But what's amazing is that they actually got the state of Florida to study this stuff, which apparently is prayed over. This is a Jewish, like a Kabbalistic sort of ritual. They sort of pray over it and turn it into this supernatural water.
But the Catholics have blessed water too.
They have their holy water, yeah.
But not
celestial drops, you know.
So there's a difference between celestial and holy.
I think holy is good against demons and devils, and celestial drops is good against citrus canker, apparently.
Okay. It's a level thing. It's a hierarchy.
I guess so.
Okay.
But, you know, the concern, of course, is that the company that sells these celestial drops will use the fact that it's being studied by the state of Florida as a promotional marketing tool, you know. So you can't even just studying it. Forget about what the results of the study are. Just the study itself gets used as a marketing tool. So we'll keep an eye on that and see how that goes, I wonder.
Any price tag on that study? Was there any information with regards to that?
The article that I don't see.
Wasn't there some sort of resolution that they actually did some studies, found no evidence of any efficacy at all, and kind of abandoned it? Did I, I thought I read something about some sort of resolution to the whole thing. I don't.
It just says that they spent 6 months developing a protocol and that they finally started studying it. I don't see any results.
How recent is the piece?
This month.
Okay, then it's a problem. I would assume not then, Bob.
Right. But we'll see if we could dig up anything else on it for the next show. We'll give
you
an update. But it looks like it's just they're beginning the study. No price tag on it listed in the...
We'll keep an eye out.
Yeah. And finally, on the news segment, Perry, I think you sent me this one, Professor Lauren Coleman at the University of Southern Maine said that he was going to formally announce $1 million prize for any evidence which leads to the capture of a live Bigfoot. So this is not just for the evidence itself, but only evidence that results in the capture of a live specimen.
The $1 million was for an actual specimen. That's correct.
Yes, that's right. But apparently you didn't have to produce the specimen, just evidence that led to the capture of the specimen. Dr. Coleman is a cryptozoologist, so she studies, mythological or mysterious animals.
Well, that's a coincidence, because I put out an offer of $1 trillion for anyone that gives me evidence that leads to Bigfoot. So,
is that true?
So cool, yeah, oh yeah, $1 trillion.
Well, I think what we could do, the New England Skeptical Society, the NES, can formally offer, whatever, any sum that we wish, million, billion, trillion, whatever, for evidence leading to the capture of a live Bigfoot. I'd be willing to take that chance.
Absolutely.
Of course, James Randi has had his own $1 million up for some number of years now.
Right, the $1 million psychic challenge, which we do occasional screening for. But Randy's purpose is to basically force those with paranormal or supernatural claims
to put up or shut up.
To put up or shut up. He said, listen, I'm going to put up $1 million. I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I don't believe you can prove that you have supernatural or magical powers. If you can prove it in reasonable, scientific, controlled observation setting, I'll give you $1 million. And that money is sitting in escrow. He can't, chintz out on it. If somebody fulfills the criteria, they get the money. My sense is from reading the articles about Dr. Coleman is, however, that she is sincere. She's not doing this to prove that Bigfoot doesn't exist by forcing the Bigfoot community to put up or shut up. She's doing this because she wants to find Bigfoot. Is that your sense too, Perry?
Absolutely. In fact, I think the whole thing is that my sense of this is that Coleman was able to convince a toy company, which with further investigation I discovered was in fact Hasbro, to put up this money, to generate interest. I'm sure that they would then, use whatever was brought in to their own marketing benefits to sell more toys and figures, trading cards and everything else that they make. But, of course, the piece goes on. A subsequent piece stated that the offer was, in fact, withdrawn prior to it even being formally announced, because the lawyers got wind of it, and they're worried about people hurting themselves.
Right. Not that they're worried they're going to give the $1 million away. They're worried that somebody will hurt themselves questing for the picture of Bigfoot and then sue Hasbro.
Exactly.
Which is ridiculous, in my opinion.
They were afraid. In fact, the way Coleman says it, they were afraid someone was going to get hurt in the frenzy to find and photograph one of these creatures to find it.
I don't understand the connection between Hasbro and Bigfoot.
Well, it's not specific, Bob, but I assume it's he was able to convince them to put the money up, though it's not stated, because in some way they were going to use it. They were going to use it to market toys, maybe. Action figures of Sasquatch.
Yeah, they've got a huge Bigfoot line of toys ready to launch as soon as somebody brings evidence.
Bob. The Abominable Snowman, the Loch Ness Monster, anything.
The whole collection, right?
The whole collection.
Cryptozoological collection.
That's right.
Well, actually, they replaced the $1 million offer for a live Bigfoot with a $5,000 offer for just the best photo. So
that's
correct. There's now a photo contest. Yeah. Maybe we could send in some blurry photo of Perry in a gorilla costume. Make a quick 5G.
I wear a size 12. probably wear a 13.
Send a picture of Larry with no shirt on.
Our hairy friend Larry.
Okay.
So that was what was skeptically in the news this week. So let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time to play Science or Fiction.
Are you all ready? So there is a theme this week, inspired by the Bigfoot piece. Again, Science or Fiction is a game that we play on the Skeptic's Guide. I come up with three news items. Either these are science facts or science news items. Two are real, two are science, and one is fiction, one I made up. And my panel of skeptics tonight, Bob and Perry, have to figure out which one is the fake. The theme tonight is mythical creatures. Now, they are all involve paleontologists discovering a fossil evidence that has been likened to some mythical creature. And I'll tell you the three creatures, then I'll read the full headlines. So, number one is Godzilla. Number two is leprechauns. And number three is King Kong. Now, keep in mind, two of these are real. So, did paleontologists find fossil evidence of Godzilla off the southern tip of South America? That's one of the headlines. Researchers discover fossil evidence of a short-statured race of humans dubbed, in quotes, leprechauns, in the British Isles. Or, researchers have discovered the remains of King Kong, a giant gorilla that lived alongside early humans.
Okay.
So what do you think, Perry? Godzilla, leprechauns, or King Kong?
Tell me the Godzilla one again.
Just paleontologists find fossil evidence of, in quotes, Godzilla off the southern tip of South America.
Yeah, that's you know, I'd have to say that one is the other ones, you know. Big monkey, sure. Short people would probably get the nickname leprechaun in Britannia, so I'll say the first one.
Alrighty. Bob?
Well, let's see. Godzilla, you know, I didn't actually read it, but I came across articles recently about some nasty predator that was recently discovered. And unfortunately, I'm very upset with myself now, but I never got a chance to read it, and I think that's what Godzilla's probably. King Kong, that could be the discovery of Gigantopithecus, which was basically a 10-foot tall, very early human found in South America. So that's my guess for King Kong, a giant ape-like creature. Leprechauns, now that, little people, I mean, there's the famous discovery in the past couple of years of 4 and 5 foot tall people, or maybe even smaller, but they were referred to hobbits. Everybody's referring to them as hobbits, not leprechauns. So I might have to go with that one, because I've never heard them referred to as leprechauns, and I would think, in England they would stick with the hobbit appellation that people have been using, and not leprechauns. So I think I'll go with leprechauns.
Alrighty. Well, I'm just going to say, just rather than going one by one, Bob, you nailed it on the head.
Yeah.
You got everyone exactly right.
Okay.
So we'll start with Godzilla. I thought that was the easiest one, because I figured that you guys would just, you know, figure it was a dinosaur, you know. But and you'd be close. It wasn't an actual dinosaur. It was actually a crocodile ancestor. So it's being dubbed, you know, Godzilla. But this is a crocodile bigger than Tyrannosaurus rex. It was fully aquatic, so that it was not amphibious, so it didn't come out of the water like modern-day crocodiles. It was fully aquatic. But
bigger than T-Rex.
But was carnivorous, had, you know, a huge jaw full of teeth. So the Dacosaurus andegensis. So that is the Latin name, being dubbed by the scientists who discovered it as Godzilla. The giant ape is Gigantopithecus. So you were right there again, Bob. So this is there have been species of Gigantopithecus discovered in the past. This is a new species, Gigantopithecus blackii. Now it's a primate, although it's not a hominid, Bob. So it was not human. It is the largest primate that has ever lived so far discovered. It's over 10 feet. Over 10 feet. So that's huge. I mean, it's not really King Kong size, but I mean, imagine a gorilla over 10 feet tall. That's a monster.
Imagine how strong he was.
Wow. And this fossil was found in Southeast Asia.
Okay.
In China, I think, specifically, but they roamed Southeast Asia. The leprechauns I made up, it was based upon the discovery of 3-foot-tall humans in an Indonesian island that have been dubbed, as Bob said, hobbits. The discovery coming on the heels of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And I just changed that into the British Isles and leprechauns.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, yeah, that one was made up. So, Bob, you totally nailed it this time.
This time?
Yep, well,
I've pretty much nailed it all the way around, yeah.
Yeah, you did. You guys all tend to do pretty well. Perry, a good guess, but you know, Bob had the advantage of actually reading some of these articles.
Yeah, that is helpful. And in a quickie update on our celestial drops piece, in fact, that testing was already concluded. You know, what's interesting about it is... it was ordered down there in Florida by Catherine Harris. You remember that name?
Yeah.
Either of you two?
Yeah, the post-election snapper.
That's right, the 2000 post-election. She was Secretary of State at that time. She's the one that ordered the study, and it was, in fact, completed. It took 6 months, like I said, to actually do the protocols and the test. The whole process took 6 months.
I see.
And in a report submitted by Wayne Dixon, the head of Florida's Bureau of Entomology, Nematology, and Plant Pathology, he reported that, quote, the product is a hoax and not based on any credible known science. He added, I wish to maintain our standing in the scientific community and not allow the developers of celestial drops to use our hard-earned credibility to promote their product.
Shocker. So it's a hoax.
That's what their study actually did find. I don't know why Mrs. Harris decided that celestial drops needed testing. I can't imagine.
So how much money was spent to
there's no figure, but you know, the state spending 6 months on it.
A cool million at least.
Yeah, just as a side note, do either of you know what nematology is? Nematology.
Study of nematodes?
Yeah, that's my first thought.
That's what I would guess.
I don't know. It's just a word I'm not familiar with. I'll have to look that up. All right. That's all. It's a quickie update for the hardworking folks at your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Well, and speaking of idiocy, let's move on to our favorite topic, intelligent design. Intelligent design remains in the news. This is definitely a hot-button topic this year. So the update that I'd like to talk about is last Tuesday's voting. One of the smaller items that came out of the Tuesday's election was that the Dover, Pennsylvania school board members, 8 of them, who supported an initiative to introduce intelligent design into the Dover public schools, were voted out, voted off of the school board. So this is similar to what happened in Kansas. If you remember, you know, a few years ago when the state school board, removed evolution and the Big Bang and some other things from the state science standards. And there was a big to-do about that. Kansas basically was, you know, embarrassed. The board members who supported that initiative were voted out. However, 2 years later, which is, I believe, last year, the conservatives were voted back onto the board, and now they're at it again, reintroducing creationist agenda into the Kansas science standards. Now, rather than removing evolution or introducing intelligent design, they are simply introducing mandated criticism of evolution, like including the notion that evolution is not proven, that it's controversial, that, you know, which
gaps in the theory.
Right, right. So. Actually, you know, I remember when we had Chris Mooney on, he predicted that was the next step, that And that might be a harder legal battle to fight because it's not introducing any notion which could be claimed to be religious, such as intelligent design. It's just being critical of evolution. But
didn't they also want to just have a quick mention of a recommendation of a book to describe the leading competitive theory?
Was that Kansas or Dover? Was that Kansas?
Yeah, you're right. I'm not sure. It might have been Dover, but okay.
Yeah, there was a reference to the Panda's Thumb, which is an intelligent design propaganda book, basically. Right, saying students may want to look at this reference for further information about, skepticism about evolution.
Right.
Now, so we'll see what happens in Dover. I mean, I think it's good that, when attention is paid to these issues, that the public acts sensibly and votes out the radicals who are basically trying to impose their narrow agenda on the public schools. But I don't know if history will repeat itself, just like in Kansas, after attention wanes. Will the creationists still be there? Basically waiting in the wings and then pounce again once public attention is on the wane.
Especially though, I think I read somewhere that the margin, the voting margin wasn't a landslide victory. It was relatively close. I think
that's what I read too, Bob. I was actually trying to find the exact vote, and I couldn't find it. I mean, I looked for quite a while, and I couldn't get the exact numbers. There's actually one member of the board who's protesting the election, wants a recount, because he says felt the machines were not accurate or such. And he wants a recount. But I would have liked to have seen the raw data, because I heard it was closer than one might have imagined.
No.
That's too bad.
Televangelist Pat Robertson, he was the host of the 700 Club.
Founder of the Christian Broadcasting Network and Christian Coalition.
Had this to say about the vote. He said that if the citizens of Dover find themselves the victim of some natural catastrophe or disaster, that they shouldn't go praying to God or looking to God for help because they've already kicked God out of Pennsylvania.
I think the exact quote.
He stopped short of saying that a disaster will happen. But if one happens to strike the good citizens of Dover, Pennsylvania, they only have themselves to blame, and they shouldn't go praying to God for help.
Is that unbelievable? Yeah. I mean, and just this past summer, he made some provocative statements. Do you remember this summer? I think it was July, calling for the assassination of Venezuelan.
Yes.
Was it President Hugo Chavez?
Right.
One
called
of
for his assassination.
Bush's critics. But
wacko.
It's funny though. But it's funny. I thought ID was a scientific theory. It doesn't have anything to do with religion. So why is he invoking God so much? Why is he so upset? Right.
Right. Yeah. It's a good point. I mean, the movement loses credibility. Again, they're trying to be coy with ID, saying that we're not talking about God, just some abstract intelligent designer, not the Christian God. But the reactions of people like Pat Robertson are very telling.
Absolutely.
It's that the Christian community, fundamentalist Christian community, who are behind intelligent design, and they know very well who the intelligent designer is.
And also, Robertson, in 1998, he issued a warning to Orlando, Florida, that they risked natural disasters like hurricanes, earthquakes, and not-so-natural ones like terrorist bombs because they allowed homosexual organizations to put up these rainbow flags in support of, sexual diversity and stuff. So, I mean, This is his.
He's a fire.
This is his
MO.
I mean, things don't go his way, and he makes these dire predictions and forecasts. Like, come on.
He's getting kind of old and cranky, His presidential run didn't go quite the way he wanted it. He's getting a little cranky in his old. That's my opinion. What else I've always found intriguing is that the most powerful evidence I've ever personally encountered for evolution. Is the few humans around who are, in fact, more primate than human. Interestingly enough, most of which have been elected to the Kansas Board of Education.
Aha.
You mean more ape than human. Humans are primates.
More ape than human. Yes.
Pat Robertson's ministry, he's got 41 million members, making him the third largest Christian ministry in the world. After who? Two people.
The Pope.
Yeah.
Moral Majority. What's the... Farwell.
Jerry Falwell?
No.
No.
I have here Oral Roberts.
Oral
he's number three. 41 million. A million people listening to his television broadcast.
Is Oral Roberts still around? I don't ever hear from him anymore.
Yeah, that's what my...
Isn't he the one that confessed his sins with the young girl or whatever?
Can you be more specific?
No.
Can you be more specific, Perry?
That was Jimmy Swaggart.
Oh, that was Swaggart. Thank you. Thank you. I could,
yeah, which one that confessed his sins?
I couldn't keep my invalid.
That was Jimmy Baker.
Evangelicals straight. Baker went to jail, right?
Yeah. And his wife, Tammy Faye, went to reality television.
She did. She did.
You know, for some reason, I watched that season of... I watched that season of Surreal Life. For some reason, I watched the first episode, and...
I'm sorry, Bob. You're fired from The Skeptic's Guide.
Well, come on. I would just watch it. You know why? You know the only reason I watched it? I remember now. I read a review on Reality News Online. Some guy reviewed it, and he said, wow, this was an interesting episode. And he said, all these stars, like the Chips guy, what's his name, Dark Hair, and Tammy Faye, and the guy from Chips, and a couple other people. And
the guy
said,
from Chips?
Was it Vanilla Ice on there, too?
The one who's selling real estate in Florida now, that guy?
And this guy gave such a glowing review of the episode. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Surreal Life? Tammy Faye and all these guys, and he said this was such an entertaining episode. Well, needless to say, it piqued my interest. I watched the first episode, and I enjoyed it, surprisingly. I watched the season. I got my brother Jay into it, and we liked it. There's something about it that you just didn't expect from these people. And even Tammy Faye, it took me a while, but I actually kind of warmed up to her because she didn't spout any... Nothing religious came out of her mouth, really. I mean, she was very religious light. It just
She toned down her image.
She toned it down.
She had nowhere else to go, though. Let's face it.
Well, she was very pleasant. She was nice. Just not really what I expected. This woman that was always preaching to people. None of that happened. And even the porn actor Ron Jeremy. Who was like the only? He seemed skeptical to me. He was the only skeptic in the whole group because Vanilla Ice was spouting this stuff how we descended from aliens and aliens came from this planet, and he just just coolly talking to him, trying to throw evidence at him or just some good questions, some critical thinking,
right.
And he actually seemed like a skeptic to me. And the guy was just so much so funny, and actually. Ron Jeremy and Tammy Faye hit it off and became buddies.
Yeah, once again,
close.
We see the correlation between skepticism and pornography.
Right.
Of course.
Over and over. Just a pattern.
I've always known was there.
It was
interesting. That's interesting that it was. I couldn't watch that show, but
I suppose.
So a final word on this intelligent design update. It's nice that the intelligent design board members were voted out. I mean that's very
very laudable.
Very laudable. But it's not a last. As we saw in Kansas, those victories are not lasting. The only lasting victories are in the Supreme Court. So when this we're still waiting for the decision about the constitutionality of forcing the teaching of intelligent design in the public schools based upon the parents who brought suits against the Dover school system for doing that. So we have yet to see the final resolution of that. And again, I believe it's at the state level now, and if it doesn't get struck down at that level, then perhaps it will go to the Supreme Court level. But when those court decisions get handed down, they produce enduring victories for our side. Of course, the Supreme Court is undergoing a radical change this year, and it remains to be seen, how these issues are going to play out in the Supreme Court. So we will have to wait and see.
And for those of you who are wondering out there, nematology is, in fact, the study of nematodes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And nematodes are any of several worms in the phylum Nematoda. having unsegmented cylindrical bodies, often narrowing at each end and including parasitic forms such as the hookworm and pinworm, also called roundworm.
Worms. There you have it. Parasitic worms. There you go.
For the edification of our millions of listeners.
Nice. We're almost up there with Pat Robertson. So, Bob, you've been you sent me this piece on the article is called Putting the Psi, P-S-I, into Science, about ESP experiments. Why don't you tell us about that?
It's an interesting article from the Guardian from September. And they talk about this, what they describe as Britain's oddest lab called the Kessler Parapsychology Unit at the University of Edinburgh. They do a lot of the usual stuff that they study. They do experiments involving ESP, psychokinesis, clairvoyance, hauntings, out-of-body experiences. But they really make an effort. They make a really, I don't know, they really put a lot of stock into the respectability of their experiments and how rigorous their science is. The acting head of the unit, Carolyn Watt, says that parapsychologists make extraordinary claims, so they must take extraordinary care in their experiments.
Right.
Now, interesting comment from someone doing experiments with ESP and stuff, but she's right. Extraordinary care, yes, but you also need extraordinary evidence, and that's something that still, even after all
right.
all these experiments, even this institute lacks. So you've got to go a little beyond the care. Because after a while, once you spend enough time with your extraordinarily careful experiments, you got to conclude, well, you know, there's really nothing here. Let's go on to something else. They do one of their big experiments that they do very often are the Ganzfeld experiments.
Yes.
That has telepathic communication. And the setup is basically they got a sender in front of a video monitor, and there's a receiver who sees four videos. One of them was the one that the sender saw, and the other ones, the other four or three, are decoys. And you would think 25% should be correct. Now, some of the largest studies that they did show a small bias of up to 5% towards them choosing correctly. Now, the reporter says, impressive if it's true. I mean, does that seem impressive to you guys, of up to 5%? I'm not impressed by that at all. I mean,
yeah, it's a residue. I mean, the yeah. Ganzfeld experiments were used for a number of years by the CIA. They
right.
in fact, invested $20 million taxpayer dollars in the Ganzfeld experiments. And they eventually abandoned it, saying that this was worthless. I mean, they were hoping to develop psychic spies, you know, but there was like a 2 or 3%, I think is what they came up with in terms of an excess correct
right.
selections. But there were outstanding criticisms of those protocols that were never resolved. For example, there was the position of like the four choices. The position of the correct choice was not entirely random, and it occurred in the first position more often than
okay.
the other three. So if there was any bias of the receiver towards choosing the first image, that could account for part of this effect.
But even though it was a couple percentage points.
Right. Hardly, you know, worthy of rewriting the physics books.
Right.
Or the neuroanatomy books.
And this institute is claiming up to 5%, which isn't very impressive to me at all. Maybe statistically it's you know, minimally significant, but
right.
I don't know. And one of the workers there, one of the physicists, was asked, you know, how does this work? Which I think is an interesting question, because after a while it gets kind of boring, you know, to go over the experiments and stuff over and over and try to show all these different ways and see how it manifests itself.
Right.
Eventually I like to think, you know, all right, let's assume that there is something here. What would be required for it to work? And this is what this guy's asked. And he said, we still don't know. His name is Paul Stevens. He said, there must be a physical basis. If there isn't, then we're moving into the realm of the supernatural. But he admits the research has so far been fruitless. So,
yes.
Which I like. I enjoy those kind of questions. And if you, hopefully, if he studied and tried to determine how it might be, hopefully he would have looked at, you know, some of the fundamental forces of nature to try. I mean, that's how I would try to explain it. Okay, if there's this force or this power or this energy, then you'd have to look at the fundamental forces. And I wrote an article on that a few years ago, and mm-hmm. and looking at all the forces, and it was interesting. And but of course, all of them easily, preclude an explanation for this. I mean, gravity's too weak for the masses involved, and also how, if your brain was somehow using gravity, which kind of sounds bizarre, I mean, how would it even modulate a gravity wave in order to send this type of information? So gravity is definitely out. The weak force works over nuclear distances, and that drops off very quickly. So that, I'm sure that can't be yet. And same for the strong force. The one that seemed most likely at first blush would be the electromagnetic spectrum. But the brain is simply not a transmitter or receiver for electromagnetic waves.
Right.
I mean, just the shape of the head and the way the brain works and everything, it's just not designed to receive or transmit any electromagnetic radiation. And then, of course, it'd be so easy to detect. I mean, we've got detectors that can detect anything, from gamma rays to radio waves. We would, you'd think somebody would have said, oh, what's this kind of spurious signal?
Well, I mean, just to be clear, though, the brain does produce magnetic and electrical waves, and that we can record.
Right.
There's an electroencephalogram, which is a measurement of the electrical fields produced by the electrical currents of the neurons, which you can measure at the scalp surface.
Right.
And there's also MEG, magnetic encephalogram, magnetoencephalogram, which uses a very large device that detects the much, much weaker magnetic fields produced by, the electrical current traveling through the pathways in the brain. But these are not signals.
Right.
This
it's,
is just
it's internal,
the fields, the fields generated by the moving current in the brain. And they are incredibly attenuated by the skull. And they also drop off very quickly with distance. So not really a candidate for ESP. So you raise some interesting issues I just want to highlight and talk about a little bit. One is the difference between when you're talking about a paranormal claim like ESP, and we talked about this a little bit on the last show about astrology. There's research which is designed to answer the question of, does this phenomenon exist? And then another type of research which is designed to ask the question of, how could it work? What would the mechanism be?
Mm-hmm.
And it is true that these are separate questions. Now, the true believers will often, whenever any question about mechanism comes up, they hide behind the notion that, well, that's unimportant. The only thing that really matters is, does it work? And that's true to a degree, to the degree that the absence of a known or provable mechanism doesn't mean a phenomenon isn't real, but it does speak to the prior plausibility of that phenomenon existing. We are at a stage in our development of scientific knowledge where we know something significantly more than nothing about the way the universe works. And, we have accumulated enough knowledge at this point where we can make some educated guess about the plausibility of whether or not something is possible. But having said that, if a truly anomalous phenomenon could be adequately proven and reproducible, even though we had no way of explaining how it could possibly work, I would still accept that that's a real phenomenon. But the burden of proof is certainly pretty high. So with ESP, the fact that there's no plausible explanation doesn't tell you it's not real, but it tells you something about, how much evidence would be required for us to accept that this phenomenon is real. So far, all we get are these few percentage points, anomalous percentage points in well-designed, rigorous studies, which could easily be due to just minor fluctuations or flaws in the methodology. Nothing concrete.
Yeah, you would think there'd be at least one experiment or one person that could, unequivocally, prove to you that there's some phenomena there and not some subtle little anomaly.
There's no smoking gun. There's nothing really is generally accepted as clear-cut evidence that there is a real phenomenon going on. So absent that, the fact that there's no plausible mechanism, you take the combination of those two things, you know, leads a reasonable scientific person to the conclusion that this is probably not a real phenomenon. And that's where we are right now. You can also, I think, look over time and say, well, you know, has the probability of this phenomenon existing changed? As we learn more about nature and as more and more efforts to document its existence are carried out, are we getting at all closer to evidence for it? And with ESP, the answer is clearly no. 100 years ago,
the opposite.
You know, it was the same situation as to basically where we are right now. Basically, over the last 100 years of parapsychological research, there have been, you know, there's no more evidence for existence than there was, and there's nothing has emerged that is even a candidate plausible mechanism. So you have the dimension of time to add to that. Whereas, take for example evolution. You know, 150 years ago, nobody knew what the mechanism of evolution was. What we thought we knew about inheritance was really incompatible with evolutionary theory. There was scant fossil evidence, and you know, we didn't really understand a lot about the mechanisms of evolution. And over the last 150, you know, if we were in the same place today that we were 150 years ago, that would be reason for skepticism about evolution.
Absolutely.
But instead, we discovered genetics and DNA, population, you know, genetics, and there's been a host of new discoveries which have all dramatically supported and reinforced the theory of evolution. The same is not true for ESP.
Right. I mean, it's transformed biology. It's the one single unifying concept in biology.
Right, and ESP has achieved no tangible effects or outcome. So it leaves a reasonable person skeptical of its existence. Well, we have a pleasant surprise. Evan Bernstein has decided to join us for the last segment of our show. Evan, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide tonight.
Thank you very much. I'd have been here earlier had I not been abducted by aliens on the way home tonight.
We're glad you managed to effect an escape.
Be able to wiggle off the probe.
It was more of a release. It was more of a release than an escape. And yes, the probing was actually, tolerable, I would say.
Yeah. He would have been here earlier, but he didn't want to cut the probing short.
Yeah, right. Thank you.
Well, Evan, since you're just joining us, why don't we do a topic that you sent in this week? You have been reading a bit about a man by the name of Lloyd Pye, who was featured in an article I wrote a few years ago. Why don't you tell us what you came up with?
I came across Lloyd Pye when I was just searching through some links today on the web, of course. And the folks at yesweekly.com, I guess I have to credit them, is posting an article about UFOlogists and how they're weighing in on the human origin debate. You know, of course, the human origin debate is the hot topic in skeptical realms and popular news articles these days, of course. And, you know, of course, we've been talking a lot about evolution and we've been talking a lot about creationism, but there's a whole other aspect of the origin of man that I don't know that we've touched on thoroughly, and that is the intervention theory.
That we are planted here by aliens.
Yes, which this gentleman, Lloyd Pye, along with another cohort of his, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Is that P-I-E or P-I?
P-Y-E, Lloyd Pye. And he appeared at a MUFON convention recently, and that's what this article was about.
That's a mutual UFO network.
Right,
MUFON, right.
Right. And he was one of the key speakers, and of course gave his presentation again in regards to his intervention theory.
Lloyd Pye, by the way, is what we technically refer to as a Looney Tune.
I love those technical words.
Well, that's for lack of a better term, because he really, I don't know what terminology he fits or not. But
he's the author of the book, by the way, Everything You Know Is Wrong. Right?
That's
Isn't
right.
That him? Yeah.
And speaking of which, Steve, if you were to go to this person's website and you would click on the Everything You Know Is Wrong little link they have there, some questions come up that he poses. Have you ever wondered why humans only use about 10% of our massively supercharged brains? Why savants can somehow access parts of the remaining 90%? Why humans have a gene pool with over 4,000 genetic defects? why our closest genetic relatives, chimps and gorillas, have very few.
That's just wrong. That's just actually incorrect.
Oh, I mean, and it goes on. I mean, right. this list is 2 pages long.
Right.
Of this and other similar interesting.
I think the
questions
the book should have been titled "Everything I Know Is Wrong." I, meaning Lloyd Pye. For, you know, just the 10% of the brain, that's a total myth. There's an article on the Nest website about that. I think it's called 90% of a brain is a terrible thing to waste. and, you know, the reason why there is so much junk in our DNA, it is speculated, is that it's fertile ground for evolutionary change, for adaptation.
Now, Steve, I haven't read his book, but I'm going to almost guarantee that your conclusions are totally 100% different from his conclusions.
Different, yes, different.
And, you, of course, you're speaking about the featured speaker at the MUFON convention. So I think we should show it its proper respect. Steve, you had written previously about this gentleman. He came up, if you do a Google search for this person's name and you type in the word skeptic right after it and do a Google search, the first link that comes up, Steve, is an article that you wrote for the New England Journal of Skepticism back in the year 2000.
Right.
Relating to the Star Child.
The Star Child Project.
Media phenomenon,
right.
that I guess it was at the time.
By the way, I recently updated that article, and it's now a featured article on our homepage because it was updated.
And it looks good. Looks good up there, I must say. And I do recall reading this a few years ago, but it was nice to go over and read again, because not only do you give a very good explanation about how science versus pseudoscience, what the differences are and how to tell the difference between the two, you do an excellent job of that. You use the Star Child case as really a...
As an example of pseudoscience.
A good example of pseudoscience in which you're able to really point out with ease all the hundreds of flaws, it would seem, that Mr. Pye constantly is making when making his arguments about about this skull that they found from...
Allegedly, right. The skull, so just quickly to encapsulate the Star Child Project, a number of years ago, an individual, I can't remember the name, had in his possession the skull of apparently of a child with a large malformed head. Now, he had a story about where the skull came from, but there was no documentation of the provenance, the prior history of this skull. It just comes out of nowhere, which is always a red flag for a hoax. But even if you take it at face value, it was discovered in a cave in Mexico along with an adult female skeleton. Now, because of the large sort of bulbous skull on this child's skull, it can sort of be reminiscent of the big-headed gray alien. So it was dubbed a Star Child, and if, you know, this guy Lloyd Pye believes that it is the product of a human-alien breeding program, which, again, is his intervention theory, right?
That's correct.
Now, what's interesting is, you know, how he has managed to convince himself to argue that this skull is anomalous, not only anomalous or unexplainable, but therefore an alien human hybrid. He, you know, dismisses a couple of, you know, kind of silly explanations out of hand, and that's the extent of his attempts to scientifically explain the skull. I took one glance, and, you know, again, I'm a neurologist for those who don't know. I took one glance, and I'm like, God, that kid has hydrocephalus, which is a pretty, you know, common, well-known entity. On my article, I included a picture out of a textbook of a child with hydrocephalus, and it looks pretty similar to the skull. He doesn't even address that as a possibility. So... again, sort of one of the features of pseudoscience is the preference for the supernatural.
Steve, couldn't you in fact say that all hydrocephalic children are in fact alien human half breeds?
Well, hydrocephalics, what basically that means is that there's a blockage in the flow of the water inside the brain, the cerebrospinal fluid, and the large bulbous head develops over time if it's not surgically corrected. So it's a strictly anatomical, you know, phenomenon that's well understood and curable. There's nothing, and if you put up just a drainage tube in these kids' heads, they're perfectly normal, you know, human children. So it's not compatible with, you know, a genetically alien hybrid half breed.
Yeah, wouldn't a DNA test just put the whole question to bed? I mean,
now you would think so. You know, so you know, Gordon Pye did have some samples of the skull DNA tested, and you know, if you were a sincere, honest, intellectually honest scientist, the DNA test would have put any notion of a hybrid to rest. So there are two levels, basically, to the DNA testing. One is just a chromosomal analysis, so looking at, you know, the chromosomes are the individual clumps of DNA that make up our DNA. And, you know, we have 22 pairs of chromosomes in humans. And so the bone from the alleged star child had a chromosomal analysis, and what it showed was that he had an X chromosome and a Y chromosome. The X is, female, and the Y is male. You know, women are XX and men are XY. So women can only give an X to their children. A male can either give an X or a Y. If they give an X, the child's female. If they give a Y, the child is male. So, Pye concluded that was, even though it was not what he predicted would be seen, he interpreted after the fact as being consistent with a hybrid. However, he doesn't answer the question. It's actually incompatible with a hybrid for the following reason. If his mother was human and the father was alien, where did the human Y chromosome come from? Because the human mother could only give the X. The alien apparently has no human chromosomes and has something else entirely. So
where did it get the Y?
Where did they get the human Y chromosome from?
Well, that question shows a complete lack of understanding
of alien
of alien birth technology.
Of course.
And their various test tube methodology.
Right, right.
But a close-minded skeptic like yourself, I expect nothing less.
Right. I mean, you could obviously concoct, as you were parroting, a hypothesis that's not falsifiable by the DNA evidence. In other words, whatever you find in the DNA evidence is compatible with your magical aliens. You could do whatever you want.
You call it special pleading. Alien breeding.
Right.
Steve, I liked in your article here, you wrote, as Carl Sagan once pointed out, alien genetic instructions, the product of a completely different evolutionary past, would be incompatible with human DNA. We would have more luck breeding a human with a petunia than an
right.
alien.
Yeah. That's right. We have more in common genetically with a petunia than with an alien. that's correct. I mean, you know, it's absurd, actually.
It really is.
They wouldn't have the same genetic code. They wouldn't necessarily have the same amino acids. There'd be no basis for commonality between the two. But anyway, so the second level would be sequencing the DNA itself. Now, they were able to sequence the DNA of the female adult skeleton that was found with the child, and they were able to tell that she was not his mother. So it was a female caretaker, but not the child's biological mother, which I don't see as being relevant one way or the other to the alien hypothesis. But they were not able to sequence the DNA from the child because the amplification techniques are not yet powerful enough to do that. But they're hoping that within a few years they'll be able to do that. That has not been done yet, as far as as I was able to tell as of a week ago.
They're always on the edge.
Right. But Pye is ever confident that the analysis will show something anomalous.
I wouldn't be surprised if he's asking people for donations so that he could further his research and get those next couple of years of research under his belt, so he can prove to the entire scientific community that his findings and his hypothesis is totally correct.
Right.
I guess we'll see. Yawn.
Right. Of course, at the same time, he evinces utter disdain for the scientific community.
Oh, yeah.
Again, another sort of pseudoscientific characteristic.
You want a couple gems that I pulled from this article? Here's just a couple things that this article from YesWeekly.com. A couple quotes. Here, Pi says, "Science would have you believe that Mother Nature created us. It isn't natural. It happened in a genetics lab." Cheetahs are weird, he says. The tan portion of their coat is composed of dog fur, while black spots are cat hair. Scientists have ignored this obvious evidence of prehistoric cloning because they cannot explain it.
Wow.
Right. That's Scientists right. always ignore evidence they can't explain.
That's right.
Rather than the reality, which is, you know, evidence that can't be explained is the basis of grants and careers, because that's where the research is.
Well, he claims he's never going to be treated with the same kind of respect of those in the scientific community, because this is something no one really wants the answer to.
Yeah, that's
that is the answer of where we have come from and what we are all about. So.
Everyone wants to know the answer to that. Everyone, and any scientist who could prove something fantastical, like, you know, we were planted here by aliens, or, you know, true genetic anomalies, you know, would be able to get the Nobel Prize, would be world famous, would be able to build a career out of that. And there would be thousands of spin-off careers on that if that were, in fact, the truth and where the research led. It's just absurd nonsense to claim that scientists are running away from the evidence. That is utter naivete. It's also, I'm also always amazed at the absolute hubris of people like Pi, who think that they know better than the entire scientific community. They know better than the thousands of scientists who are working throughout the world. This guy must, in their own minds, they must think of themselves as Einstein and Galileo, you know, and Darwin all rolled into one.
And they're, you know, put on little pedestals by the UFO community and the Yeti community and the Bigfoot community and other people who would, you know, believe in such nonsense.
Right.
And, you know, certainly further his own ideas in his own mind, feeling that he's doing something right.
Right.
Because he's backed up by a bunch of folks who, well, let's face it, could use some serious attention, in my opinion, by professionals.
So his talk was well received at MUFON, I take it.
Very well received. Well enough for at least half of this article that I came across. But you know, and I didn't finish my research on this, and maybe I'll conclude this another night with you guys. But also in the article came another reference to a whole other line of UFO nonsense. A gentleman by the name of David Boldman. You ever hear of this guy?
No.
All right. His area of expertise is UFO trace evidence. Mm-hmm. And he points to the phenomenon known as angel hair.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of that.
As a substance often left when flying, when UFOs pass over any particular given site. So I've begun to look into that a little, and fully concluded my findings of what's going on, but it seems to take on certainly a religious connotation, at least at first, prior to the 1947 Roswell phenomenon. For instance, when this it was attributed to angels, and that's why it was originally dubbed angel hair. Whenever there were angel sightings, the faithful would come out and see the remnants left behind by the angels' visitations, which was this spider web sort of material that was very, very thin, and it would be left all over the ground. It would literally rain from the sky on people, and you'd go to touch it, and it would sort of disappear to the touch.
Mm-hmm.
And people, of course, in the 19th century and early 20th century, the writings and the is attributed to religious phenomena such as the sighting of angels.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the term angel hair. And then, starting in around 1948, it began to be attributed to be a coincidence, or it coincided with UFO sightings.
Right.
And apparently for a couple years there, among about half of the UFO sightings on record said that this angel hair, this spider web substance, was left behind from where the alien craft was flying. And Well,
but no one has specimens of this ancient
era. No one has specimens. Someone claims to this fella from the conference claims that he does have a specimen which is currently going under testing of some sort. Let's see what it says here.
I know that they did discover that angel hair can only be cleaned with celestial water.
Right, the celestial drops.
That, I did read that.
Now, I did find what I have found so far. I've just started to uncover, because it took me, it didn't come up in my first set of Google searches, and it's not even really mentioned on any of the more popular skeptical websites. I don't even think it's in our skeptical dictionary. But I did find something here, OntarioProfessionals.com, under their weird section, angel hair. Angel hair is said to be ephemeral silky substance that falls from the sky.
Just out of touch.
Just out of touch. But apparently what it is that spiders actually do produce this material.
Sure.
They actually literally fly in the air upon this material, and they fly great distances and in great clusters and great enough numbers that the remnants of the spider webs that they're creating falls eventually to Earth, and in such quantities that it does collect and is really somewhat of a bit of a spectacular presentation. And for those people who certainly don't have any idea what it is, you know, they're likely to insert their closest held beliefs, you know, angels or UFOs or what mm-hmm. have you.
I've read about that. It's, I believe it's called mass, M-A-S-S, the quantity of spider silk that you see just kind of floating in the wind. You know, mm-hmm. these the spiders use them. It's called ballooning. They shoot out a bunch of their webbing until the wind can pick them up, and it actually. Spiders have been found, you know, near mountaintops and in the middle of the ocean because this is such an effective way of traveling. And then when they land, they just kind of, you know, release it, and it just kind of continues flying along.
I first learned about that from Charlotte's Web, that children's story.
That's right. I remember that scene. The baby
all the little,
spiders
all the little
hatch.
Baby spiders.
They secrete their web material, which and they float away on the wind.
Yeah. It's too bad, you know, Lloyd Pye and his friends didn't read Charlotte's Web. They would have been able to have had a more prosaic explanation for these angel hair.
So this David Boldman at this conference says, he says, physically it's superficially similar to spider web, but it has the unusual property of dissolving or disappearing. Ooh.
Hmm. Except when it doesn't.
He does not dismiss the idea of extraterrestrials because he thinks it would be more ridiculous if there weren't extraterrestrials secreting this material from their UFO flights. How exactly he ties into that, this article doesn't really explain that. I'm having a hard time trying to figure that one out myself by the research I'm doing. But as I find some more on this, I'll bring it up again another time and let you know what else I find. It's just interesting because I had never heard about this phenomenon at all before.
The angel hair. Yeah, I had never heard about it before, yeah.
Never heard of it. And it didn't come up on any of the, on Randy's site or PsyCop's site. They have no references to it in their literature. I found that kind of surprising.
Well, maybe we should add a reference to it on our skeptics.
We will become the official skeptic angel hair site.
Absolutely. With full references to Charlotte's Web.
Oh, sure. and color pictures.
Well, that is all the time we have for this week. It always goes by quickly. Thanks again for listening. Bob, Perry, Evan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Even though you were late, Evan. Try to be on time next week.
Okay.
For all of you out there, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For more information about this and other episodes, visit our website at www.thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kenneto and is used with permission.
That's last theorem. Let him far from the mainstream. Sleepless nights, slow burn days, problems, proofs, endless delays.